This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, The Man I Was Destined to Be, Addiction, Incarceration, and the Road Back to Glory. And the author is Michael Tandoi, as told to us by his aunt, Bonnie Travaglini. Hello, Michael.
How are you, Steve?
It's just such an honor to have you on with us. It's always great to talk to somebody who has turned their lives around the way you have. My goodness, it's an honor to have you on, Michael. 7 long years in prison, a life filled with addiction, crack cocaine, all kinds of problems with the police. But here you are today, and tell us what you're doing today.
Today we're at my shop. We're actually getting ready for this ice storm. So we've got equipment getting fixed, worked on, and we're just getting ready. We're preparing for what Mother Nature's bringing us for tonight.
Because you've literally resurrected, what was your father's old business?
Yep, my father had an asphalt company that was around for 33 years, and he passed away 3 years during my incarceration. So that midway point, my father died, and nobody in the family was able to, you know, keep the business up and going. So when I came home to, you know, pretty much my mother was able to save the shop, but there was no equipment left. The equipment had just, you know, disappeared, it vanished. So I went to work with my stepfather for a couple of months, who also owns an asphalt company. And, you know, he gave me my start into, coming home to a job. I saved my money and I just started buying equipment. And next thing you know it, I started praying and I was like, God, I need a paver. And the next day he delivered me one. And, you know, so it's like everything that happened with my asphalt company throughout the last year has just been continued blessings, you know, left and right. And, So we started pretty much from the bottom with nothing, $300 in a bank account and a big dream. And, you know, between my father up there, you know, in heaven taking care of everything, we were able to compete with just about every top name asphalt company in Rochester, New York this year. So, yeah.
Well, yeah. And this, everyone, again, is after 7 years of a prison sentence. Before that, crack cocaine addict.
Yeah.
And just as life was a mess. Well, let's go back, Michael. As you look back on your life, when did things start to change for the bad when you were young? What happened? How, you know, certainly you weren't raised this way.
No, I wasn't. You know, I mean, I was raised with a good family. You know, there was always food on the table. You know, we had manners, stuff like that. You know, I guess my image of who I thought I was, you know, I was portraying somebody that I wasn't. You know, I liked the fast life. You know, me and my friends, you know, we started getting ourselves into trouble early. You know, little neighborhood stuff, ding dong ditch, you know, things that, you know, were harmless, but they were bad. They weren't right. We weren't supposed to be doing those things. And, you know, we started drinking early. But what happened with me was, is at the age of 21 years old, I had an opportunity to take a nightclub over in Rochester, New York. And by 22, I had opened the nightclub. I borrowed a little bit of money from family. And, you know, next thing you know, I'm 22 years old and I'm running a nightclub that's got 12,000 square foot, 2 dance floors, live DJs that we were bringing in. And the first 6 months, I ran it like a business and it was beautiful. You know, I mean, it was an opportunity. It was an experience. But, you know, my cocaine addiction, I was using cocaine on the weekends. And it grew. It grew to the point where I couldn't sniff any more coke. So after that, that's when I took my first blast of crack cocaine and my entire life changed. You know, it was like a transparent screen from good to bad. And I entered a place that I had no business entering. And as soon as that happened, I mean, I lost everything quick. There was no hesitation. The devil didn't waste no time. I was stripped of everything I had ever worked for. you know, I always had a job. I worked with my father with his construction company. I was, you know, right with him from when I was a kid. I used to, you know, he used to have to put me back to sleep because I'd wake up at five, six years old, and I'd be crying because I want to go to work with my dad. You know, I mean, I was always there wanting to work, so I always had, you know, that work mentality. But as soon as I started using crack cocaine, and I'm not saying that it's okay to use any drugs, because it led my drugs, my, you know, led me to using the crack cocaine, and it just got so bad so quick. You know, and it was like my whole family was affected by it. My father used to point at his heart, and he had a bad heart. He had, you know, a couple of heart attacks throughout his lifetime, and he always used to point at his heart when he was trying to come and get me and say things like, "You're killing me, kids, you're killing me," you know, and it was just like, it was so devastating to everybody.
So your life as an addict, you were shot five times, left for dead, you were in rehabs, but for some reason, you couldn't see the light.
And it worked. Well, I think what happened was is I found a way to glorify the shootings, you know? I made it out alive. I got shot, I made it out alive, and I found a way to make good on that with, you know, glorifying it. You know, without evaluating the whole situation, instead of saying like, "Oh my God, I got shot. What did I do to deserve to get shot? And what can I do now to make sure that that never ever happens ever again?" Instead, when I relapsed, my first relapse, I bought a bag of crack cocaine on that same exact street where I got shot. You know.
Wow.
So, but they say that drug use is insanity. You know, so that was just my usage in full effect. You know, you start up where you left off. And that's
right.
Exactly where I would start up every time I would relapse.
So now you're in your 20s. You're running that, as you just pointed out, this very successful bar and a dance, I guess just a dance hall that's really successful.
Yep.
But you're using cocaine, and then... What happened with this turning point, with this high-speed chase with the police? Tell us that event.
Well, before we get to that point, after I had lost the nightclub, I went to rehab because of the shooting. I got shot. I went to rehab. I stayed clean for a year. After a year, I relapsed, and I started using again. And then I went and I got back into a rehab again, and then I got clean. And when I got clean that time, I had met a girl who turned into be my fiance at the time. And I moved in with her. We started another successful business. On top of always working, you know, asphalt for my father, I opened up a floating restaurant. It was a hot dog stand on the water. But, you know, between the stresses of everything, I ended up relapsing, and then when I relapsed that last time, that's what led onto this high-speed chase with the police department. And, you know, what happened with the police department was I got into a high-speed chase a couple of weeks before the one that ended up sending me to prison for 7 years. I got into a high-speed chase, and I was able to ditch the police department. And from that point on, the cop was so mad, which he had every right to be mad. He wanted to make sure that I got arrested for that because he knew it was me. So he had finally, after 3 or 4 weeks, he was able to produce a search warrant to come and arrest me, an arrest warrant. So when they came to get me that day, that's when I took off and got into that high-speed chase that, you know, looking back after all them years of, you know, doing my incarceration, you know, I mean, I could have killed somebody, you know, and I thank God every day that I didn't. I mean, I could have killed somebody on more than one occasion. You know, I could have been that guy that was, you know, doing a life sentence in prison for a vehicular manslaughter, you know, that I had no control over because, you know, I mean, if I were to get pulled over today, I'm stopping because I know it's the right thing to do, you know. But when I was on that stop, it was like, whatever was right was wrong. So if I was used to doing something right and I'm under the influence, I'm going to do the opposite. you know, and it was just terrible. And I see people every day, you know, I see headlines of, you know, somebody getting into a high school chase and they killed a family of five, or, you know, it's a terrible situation. And I'm just very thankful that it didn't happen with me. But I ended up getting caught. I did get into it, an accident that day. The kid did not have life-threatening injuries, thank God. But it was, that was my wrecking ball. You know, that was, I was faced with, I'm out of, you know, get out of free passes, you know, get out of jail free passes. That was lights out, you know?
So you served every bit of your time?
Well, out of the 7-year sentence, I was able to serve 5 years, 8 months because of good behavior. And I qualified for this IPA position that actually, it didn't guarantee you 6 months off, but after 2 years of completing the IPA program, it made you eligible to be released from prison 6 months earlier from your conditional release. So when I was able to apply after the 2 years of doing my IPA work, and I was actually doing it in a MICA dorm, which was a mentally ill, chemically addicted, dual diagnosis drug program that's inside the state prison system. And that was the worst of the worst. You know, the education level was like first and second grade. So, I mean, I was in a dorm with guys that, you know, their reading levels weren't up, or, you know, they had more than one problem. So if they were addicted to, you know, say crack cocaine, they were addicted to crack, but their mental health made them dual diagnosis because they had schizophrenia or something else, you know? So, you know, I was working with people that turned out to be like my greatest blessing during my incarceration, because this was my way of giving back to a community of people that needed, you know, things that I was able to offer, you know? So it turned out like my incarceration turned out to be like my main blessing, you know, because go ahead.
It was exactly what you needed.
Exactly what I needed. I needed every single day that I did is exactly the amount of time that I needed. Because my first 3 years in prison, I was still the same guy that I was on the street, minus the drugs. You know, I wasn't using drugs in prison at all, ever, not once. But I was still on the hustle. I mean, if I could have opened up a grocery store on the street corner, on the walkway, you know, I would have done that, you know, because my mentality never changed, you know. So I didn't start living this new life until my father passed away during my incarceration, you know. So it's like that's what really opened me up to a new way of living.
So that really got you thinking differently.
Yeah, well, they were, through the grace of God, I was able to be transported to see my father a day before he passed away. So, I mean, it was like completely biblical. When I was at the bedside with my father, you know, I was, you know, handcuffed from, you know, waist shackled the whole nine, but I was able to talk to my father for 2 hours, and he was able to instill the family blessings, the legacy onto me, you know, telling me like, you need to grow up. You need to become a man, you know? And I mean, I was, in my, you know, early 30s, and I'm thinking like, what are you talking about? I am a man. But little right. did I know, I was like, I didn't qualify for any kind of manhood at all, because, you know, I mean, it's a sad thing to say, but men are out taking care of responsibilities with their families. You know, men are out providing for their wives and their kids, you know, right. And, you know, it's unfortunate that we make that, you know, real bad decisions sometimes that put us away from our families, that, you know, get us incarcerated. If we're lucky, sometimes we die. We don't even get that option, you know?
Just in the time we have left, Michael, something big happened when you were in solitary confinement. Just kind of close out on what happened to you.
Yeah. Well, I was in solitary confinement. I had gotten in a lot of trouble, and I got down on my knees, and I'm just screaming and shouting to God because I was angry with him. But at the same time of being angry with him, I needed something from him. I needed to be like, I needed these charges to be dropped. I wasn't able to deal with it. So I promised him the world, you know, like when you're, you're at your lowest point in your life, and you're like, God, please help me out now. You bail me out of this, and I'll just turn over to you whatever you ask for me. And that's exactly what I did. And just like that, Airmail Express to Jesus Christ himself, a lady that used to live next door to me, she was an elder lady. She sent me a letter, and it was one of the most heartfelt letters I've ever read in my entire life, talking about how God needs me and he wants me to do right, and I've got so much potential. So when I went to the hearing that next morning, and the captain of the prison said to me, is there anything else you need to tell me? I said, yeah, I would like to read you this letter that I received from one of God's angels last night. I read him the letter, and just like that, it was case dismissed. And little by little, it was like a pot of sauce. You know, I just got stirred up, and whatever ways that I might have used to have, he just changed them up, and he just started using me for a different purpose in his life. Yeah. It was pretty incredible.
So it doesn't matter. Doesn't matter the mistakes you've made in the past. You can turn your life around with God's help and never Absolutely. Give up on yourself. That's kind of your message.
You never give up. You know, and if there's one thing I can say to these people is, you know, we are all worth it. We are all worth it. Meaning it doesn't matter how crinkled up, how much we might have been down on the ground and how dirty we got. At the end of the day, we still hold the same value, right? We are all worth saving. You know, and even today on a daily, I'm not perfect, right? I will never be perfect, and I don't believe God made us perfect. You know, we all fall short of the great glory of God. You know, but if we can learn from our mistakes and move forward, you know, that's what it's all about. It's looking up in the sky and saying the sky's the limit. You know, as long as I'm clean and sober today, there's nothing I cannot do.
I think all of us who are listening to you, Michael, would just all in one voice say amen to everything you've said. We've been listening to Michael Tandoi, the author of his book, The Man I Was Destined to Be, Addiction, Incarceration, and the Road Back to God. Michael, tell us how to get your book.
You can order my book through Amazon.com. You can order it through BarnesandNoble.com. And you just plug in the words, The Man I Was Destined to Be, and it's right there. You can get the ebook. You can get a soft cover or a hard cover. And if anybody wants a signed copy, just email me, mtandoi18@gmail.com, and we'll make arrangements for that.
Thank you so much, Michael, for being with us on Indie Book Publishing.
Thank you for having me, Steve. It was a pleasure.
And this interview has been brought to everyone by Westbow Press.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Hi, everybody. This is Pete Six of Beatles and Beyond. Why don't we all come together and hear some of the tracks off the latest Beatles release on this radio station? Yes, why don't you look up the schedules on this radio station and join me and Beatles listeners everywhere to hear the latest releases from the Beatles on Beatles and Beyond with Pete Dix.
Connect with Juliana and connect with what lies beneath. Friday afternoons at 4 or 3 Central on toginet.com. Juliana is a marriage, family, and child therapist who wants people to connect. Connect with what lies beneath, those truths and answers. And through her counseling practice, she has helped others find their personal power and fulfill their dreams. And she wants to do the same for you. Here on Connect with Juliana. Through intimate discussions, intriguing subject matters, and the expertise of her guests. For more on the show and Juliana, check out her webpage. Connect with Juliana in media.com. Juliana will cover it all. Nothing is off limits. She wants to know what matters to you. Make the connection. Tune in to TogiNet to connect with Juliana to find out the facts that could be hidden beneath the surface. Connect with Juliana on TogiNet. to make a quality connection in your life. Friday afternoons at 4, 3 Central on TogiNet.com. Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book comes A Soldier's Whisper, a collection of wartime letters with reflection and hope for the future. 101st Airborne Paratrooper and the author, Jenny LaSala. Hello, Jenny.
Hi, Steve. Thank you for having me on your show.
Well, great to have you with us on Indie Book Publishing. And for everyone, this interview is brought to you by Trafford Publishing. Jenny, this is it is life-changing kind of experience when you read these personal, intimate letters from your father to your mother when he was at war. Now, where was he and what was his mission?
Well, he enlisted in the Army in 1943, and he was a country boy, grew up in Petersburg, Indiana, and he was one of six children, being the eldest, and he didn't wait for the call. He enlisted, and then when he found out about the paratroopers, he became very excited and joined what became a very elite group during World War II. He trained fast and furious, and in 1944 was in transit by sea to England, where he stayed until they got ready for their first jump into Normandy, France on D-Day. He miraculously made it through that battle, and then his group, the entire division, was called to Carentan, France, which became known as Purple Heart Lane, because of the vast number of men that died and were wounded and were awarded the Purple Heart. From there, they went and jumped into Holland in September of 1944. And from after that battle, they were called to the Battle of the Bulge, the famous Battle of the Bulge, where they were encircled by the Germans. And he made it through all four of the European battle campaigns. He writes in his book some wonderful sentiments. For example, one of them was, "I'm amazed with my life and body intact." And he called his parachute, "My silk is my silent weapon and the thread upon which my life hangs," which I found amazing for an 18, 19, and 20-year-old man to write so beautifully and so eloquently.
He was going through all kinds of emotional experiences when you think about war, which did he ever talk about it very much when you were growing up?
Actually, he did not. However, it was after my father's passing and I read the book by Tom Brokaw, The Greatest Generation, that a floodgate of memories began to come back. Things that my father did say, but I apparently had buried them. I had put them aside because some of those things that he said were pretty horrific for a young girl, one of which I remembered last year. He said that once he saw a man completely vaporized into thin air. And as a little girl, I remember him saying that, and I didn't know what to say, and I didn't respond. But apparently, it had a profound effect on me, and I tucked it away in my memory bank. Now, my mother was an avid reader, as my father was, but she had history books galore and always had the History Channel on. So I suppose that with all that playing in the background of my childhood, I did absorb it, and I retained it. And my father had a lot of sadness in his personal life growing up. He lost his mother when he was only 12, a sister who was just 1 year younger than him when he was age 11. His father passed away when he was just 18. So there was a lot of sadness. And I thought that sadness had to do solely with with his family life. But it wasn't until I read every one of the letters that I started to connect the dots, so to speak. And it brought it all together, and it brought it all home for me. And that's when I realized I have a story to tell. I have to put this into a book, not only for my children, my grandchildren, but for all soldiers of war. And then an interesting thing took place. I sent the book to my ex-husband, a Vietnam veteran. And he called me out of the blue, and he said, "Jenny, I cannot believe that your dad wrote so many sentiments that I can relate to from my wartime experience some 25 years later." And that started me on a continuing path from this book to work on the next project. I'm going to be publishing my ex-husband's wartime letters that he wrote home from Vietnam between 67 and 1968. And I post daily a story on our Facebook page, which is now over 6,700 followers, and it's growing daily. People visit every day just to read the stories I post to honor our veterans of the past, present, and future. And something funny occurred about a month ago. I was late in posting the story for the day. It was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And I had a flurry of people looking for me. And when I posted the story for the day, they said, "Oh, thank goodness. We thought we were going to miss our history lesson for the day." And I thought that was so heartwarming. But about the book, I chose the title, Comes a Soldier's Whisper, because it occurred to me the letters are almost 70 years old. And it's almost as though my father is whispering all of those sentiments all these years later that all soldiers of all wars can relate to, because war changes the soldier. It clearly changes the soldiers, too. But more importantly, I've come to realize from my personal experience growing up with a World War II veteran that these soldiers return home with the invisible scars and wounds of war. Unwittingly, they bring them home to the family. And the family is completely unprepared. They don't know.
Mm-hmm.
How could they know what their son or husband or brother or sister have endured during their war experience? And that's why I feel it's critically important to open the door for dialogue, to talk about it, and help not only the soldiers heal, but the families and the children within these families. I have two grown children, ages 30 and 33. They were most definitely affected by their father, a Vietnam veteran's experiences. We're only just now beginning to talk about it. My daughter called me after I published Come the Soldier's Whisper, and after I began communicating with her father again, because his wartime experience did have a profound effect on the end of our marriage. We didn't realize it at the time. But she called me a few months later and she said, "Blum, I can't begin to tell you how you're publishing Grandpa's letters and working on the next project with Daddy, how it's changed him." And I asked her, "How? What do you mean?" And she said, "I've never seen Dad laugh like he has been. It's almost like he's become childlike. He's easier to talk to. He's not so quick with his temper." And Stephen, I have to tell you, that was a profound moment for me, that I saw that it was healing.
Definitely.
Healing our daughter. And I can't be alone in this. I can't possibly be alone in it. And with the 7,500 followers on Facebook and people commenting and posting on the stories that are on the Facebook every day, it makes me feel so good to know that, wow, people are relating to this by, you know, the thousands. And it needs to
be
shared.
Why don't you share some of a letter with us?
Oh, that'd be great. I have one marked here. It also appears on the website where people can share stories, and that is www.comesasoldierswhisper.com. This particular letter was written in May of 1945. This was after the Battle of the Bulge ended in January 1945, the last battle of his European battle campaign. My father begins to write, "Now that my mail isn't censored, I can tell you how and when I was wounded in Holland. I'll make it brief. I just thought you might like to know. It was September 22, 1944, in Holland, at a forward observation post. I was very tired that morning, and I didn't have to go, as I hadn't slept for 48 hours. However, the day before, the British had given tank support, and we also had it for that morning. We had kicked the hell out of them the day before. The colonel asked if I was to be his radio operator that morning, and I said yes. I wanted to be in on it. He was a hell of a swell guy. Anyway, the attack had just gotten underway, and there was a devil of an explosion over our heads. That's about all I remembered for 48 hours. When I came to my senses, I thought my leg was gone. That was one terrible feeling. I think a million things must have flashed through my head at once. I probably shouldn't have told you this, but you've asked me so many times, and I just couldn't then. The same shell killed two and wounded five men. I guess it was quite a mess. Not as bad as some I've seen, though. Well, enough about that." And then he always ends his letters that way, as if he's going to give her a glimpse, his then sweetheart, who became his wife and later my mother. He wanted to give her a glimpse of trying to cope and understand what he was experiencing, but then he wanted to shut it off. He didn't want to go on and on about it.
Yeah.
And that's true of, well, it's of a, all soldiers, it's a, of all wars.
Right. It's a common thread of soldiers, as you put it, yesterday, today, and the future. They share that thread of what we've come to call post-traumatic stress disorder, this PTSD that so many of our soldiers are dealing with today.
Absolutely. It's true. And it's not isolated to any one war. It goes back all the way to the beginning of the wars. You know, the Civil War. You can name countless wars. But there was never anything in place to help the soldiers return. They were just expected to go back to civilian life, get a job, and just get back in the groove of living your life. And soldiers, for the most part, you know, they should be applauded for trying their best. But what I find interesting, Stephen, and I've lived with this, my father was a World War II veteran. Clearly, his experiences did have an effect on me and my siblings. Then my ex-husband, a Vietnam veteran, my brother did two tours in the Gulf. He came back very changed. He came back very despondent, depressed, and very angry. He never had a temper before he went in, but yet he came out with one. And unfortunately, the family didn't recognize just what was going on with my brother until 2007. And when I convinced him that he needed to go to the VA for help, he had begun going, but he gave up. He succumbed to a heart attack in 2009 and died at the age of 51. I recently attended the annual luncheon for the Battle of the Bulge veterans in West Palm Beach just last month in December, and I invited my brother's two younger sons, ages 24 and 27, and I wasn't sure if they were going to attend or not because, you know, it's not something that most youth would be interested in. They showed up at 11:30 precisely, and they didn't leave until 9 o'clock that night. There was a lot of crying and a lot of jubilation and a lot of reflection. And I could see the healing take place with my two beautiful nephews. It doesn't get better than that.
How many letters are in your book?
There are about 150 letters in this book. I have a collection of over 300 plus, but my mom and dad started writing as pen pals long before, you know, he went off to war. So they started as just friends, and the letters developed into love, honor, and sacrifice. And it's a patriotic book. It's a feel-good book. And I believe that families of soldiers today may very well be able to connect the dots and make sense of things that they're experiencing with their returning family member from the war we have today with Afghanistan. As a matter of fact, I've been sending out questionnaires to veterans of the Korean War, Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan to participate for potential publication in the next book, which will be coming out later this year. And that will be called Comes a Soldier's Whisper, Vietnam and Beyond. The reason I'm calling it And Beyond is because it will encompass letters, of course, from my ex-husband written home during Vietnam, but also it will contain stories from World War II veterans, Korea, other Vietnam veterans, Iraq, and Afghanistan, because I want to show that although they're different men and women, you will read the common thread that they share with each other. And I think that will tie it together nicely. It does need to be talked about. It needs to be understood so that we can help our military soldiers transitioning back to civilian, not only for the individual soldier, but for society as a whole. This is huge. It's not just contained to one soldier or one family. It's everyone, Americans.
This is quite a service that you're providing, Jenny. We've been listening to Jenny LaSala, her book title, Comes a Soldier's Whisper. Jenny, tell us how to get your book.
Well, they can visit Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com, or they can visit the website, www.comesasoldierswhisper.com, which will take you to the Crawford publisher or directly to Amazon and Barnes & Noble link to place the order.
And your Facebook page, what is that?
The Facebook page is just that, Comes a Soldier's Whisper. If they type that in when they search friends, that will come right up, Comes a Soldier's Whisper. And I'd love to hear from your audience.
Well, I hope they respond. We appreciate you, Jenny, for being with us on Indie Book Publishing.
Steve, thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure.
And this interview is brought to everyone by Trapper Publishing.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages. Join us for Self-Aid Success Stories with Helen Wu, Wednesday nights at 10, 9 central on toginet.com. Helen Wu was born and raised in San Francisco's Chinatown, and after a very difficult upbringing, fighting depression, abuse, and addictions, she finally finds herself genuinely happy inside and out. Helen believes in taking our positive thinking and doing something positive to achieve a positive outcome. She's here to make a positive difference in your life, to be your game changer, your aha moment mentor. She's ready to help both men and women get into a better place. Helen Wu is also the author of Self-Aid Success Stories, 25 Success Stories from Successful Entrepreneurs. Inspired by Ellen DeGeneres, Helen wants the world to know that just because we find ourselves in a difficult situation doesn't mean we have to stay there. We can aid ourselves to a better life. So join us for Self-Aid Success Stories with Helen Wu, Wednesday nights at 10, 9 central on toginet.com. Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, I Hate God, I Love God, Witches in the Church, and the author is Teresa L. Smith. And Teresa joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, this interview brought to you by Lulu Publishing. Hello, Teresa.
Hello. Thank
Great
you.
To have
yeah,
you
thank
with
you
us.
For allowing me. I'm glad to be on the show with you today.
Well, you're going to help us understand, as you put it, exposing the original hater and his plans to destroy God's people. And this book will guide a soul-searching and also challenges Christians to think of what and who the real warlocks and witches look like and how they operate. Basically, as you put it in your title, obviously hatred and love do not mix, but of course, Satan and God doesn't mix either.
That's right.
Well, tell us why you wrote this book, a little bit about your background and why you wrote the book, Teresa.
Well, I've always wanted to chronicle the highlights of many of the outstanding accomplishments of our former pastor, Prophet L.K. Johnson, who has made over the years transformed the lives of many people over the years. And I wanted to chronicle this for future generations to know about. And it's also important to chronicle some of the achievements of the elders in our families for our next generations. And this book has in part enabled me to do that while telling some of my own story.
So your own story, which includes your grandmother, who you say was a witch.
Yes, sir.
Now, when we say she's a witch, that sounds very dark.
Well, this is, yes, it does. It does. And one of the things that encouraged me to go ahead and come public with this story is that in 1 Samuel, where God told Samuel, the spirit of sullen rebellion is the same as witchcraft. God views them as one and the same. And so when we think of witchcraft and sorcery, we think of it as the darkest, most evil, vilest sin that could ever be committed. But God is saying, when you operate in stubborn rebellion and disobedience to my will, and you know the word, I view that same thing as witchcraft. There's no difference between the two in God's sight. So we often, as Christians, would like to build ourselves up as being more righteous than the next person, someone who we deem to be more dirty than ourselves. But this scripture really, it brings it down front and center for all Christians to realize that the casual sins that we think of as being, you know, small and insignificant is really big in God's sight.
Now, this curse of being a witch fell on you, but miraculously you have been changed or protected through the Prophet Johnson. Is that what happened?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. That's correct.
Well, tell us about that.
What happened? Well, my grandmother, she hated my mom and my other grandmother, because they were a positive influence on my father. And while my mother was pregnant with me, because I was my parents' seventh child out of 10 children, she believed that, you know, that I had a special calling on my life. And so Satan wanted to turn that special calling into something negative so that I could work to build his kingdom. And so it was a 40-year curse is what it was. And because I was blessed to have been under Prophet Johnson's leadership during those formative years growing up, he was able to mentor me and my family through all the negative things that would have occurred as a result of this curse. And also to protect me, so to speak, from blossoming into this other person that I was supposed to become under that witchcraft spirit.
So the 40-year curse is come and gone. You have been released from it?
Yes, sir.
And so now your mission is what? What is your mission in life now?
Well, my primary mission is to show people that regardless of what negative circumstances that you may find yourself in, that God can turn it around into something positive. He can take the curse and reverse it into a blessing. He can take those things that was meant to cause much sorrow and misery in your life, he can turn it into a ministry if we allow him to. And so that's my primary mission, to show people how they can turn negatives into positives.
Do you expect some negative backlash from your message in your book? How do you plan to deal with that kind of backlash?
Well, yes, I do expect a lot of negative backlash, and I expect a lot of people misunderstanding the message. But I believe that because my message is a mission from God, I believe that those people who intend to receive the message will get the positives from it, and their lives will be transformed as a result. So those who intended to receive the message will get it.
Mm-hmm. So you are an example. You are an example of how a generational curse can actually be broken and turned into a blessing. And from that, what would you say the backbone of moving forward then in your life and for others, once you can kind of get over this negative of curse and that everyone may have some kind of a family kind of situation that they may consider a curse. How do you get through that? What do you have to focus on?
Well, the primary thing is that you have to be rooted and grounded in God's word and be under strong spiritual leadership that can help to mentor you through or navigate you through that labyrinth of challenges that you'll have to face where the enemy wants us to give up and to turn back, and which is easy to do. And you can imagine, it's not, you know, for 40 years, and one of the things that was associated with that was a spirit of doing, if I could be very candid, doing backwards things. In the South, we used to call it doing ass backwards stuff. And that was one of the outcomes. As long as I was on the path of doing negative things, destructive things, then I could be progressive. But when I began to do positive things and moving in an upwardly mobile direction, in a godly direction, then I would find myself doing, you know, that spirit like working against me, and I would find myself doing backward stuff to supplant my own success and my own progress. So that's how it manifested with me throughout those years. And I think that most people can identify in some respects where it seems like they just find themselves doing ass backward stuff, and they don't really understand, in spite of how they try to move in a positive direction or upwardly mobile direction, they find themselves doing backwards things. And so that's how that part of that was manifested with me. And you can imagine that when you're involved in a cycle like that for 40 years, there were many times when a person would have given up or could have given up. But, you know, this is another testament of saying no matter how long or how difficult the challenge that you might face and how long it seems before you can come out of that situation, know that there's still help and there's still hope.
So regardless of how hopeless you feel or helpless you feel, God is there and will help turn your life around.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, can you help us recognize warlocks and witches that may be around us?
Well, again, when I wrote this, when the Holy Spirit led me to write this, it was written once again based on 1 Samuel and how we as Christians, once again, we often want to compare ourselves to someone whom we deem as being more filthy, more sinful than ourselves in order to justify our own sinfulness before God and saying, well, you know, at least I'm not as bad as so-and-so. At least I'm not doing those things.
Right.
But God is saying, he made it very clear, stubborn rebellion and disobedience is the same as witchcraft. And God views them as one and the same. And so in other words, God is saying, look, I don't want to hear it. Don't tell me about somebody else somewhere else. Look in the mirror at yourself. Do you see yourself? And so even though I was not involved, and I don't know anything about, you know, the black magic or spells or anything, hexes or anything like that, but yet that spirit of witchcraft was operating in me through the form of stubborn rebellion, because even though I knew the word, even though I was being taught the word, that spirit of that witchcraft spirit was manifesting in my stubborn rebellion. And as a result, I would find myself doing a lot of ass backwards stuff as a result. And so, it's just that simple. People think of witchcraft and sorcery as being all the most evil, vile, wicked thing. But God is saying, if you know the word and you've been taught the word, but yet you operate in stubborn rebellion, it's as the sin of witchcraft. And so this message causes Christians to want to take a closer look in the mirror at themselves, not looking at someone else, but to look at ourselves to see where we really stand in God's sight.
Why do you feel your book will especially be connected to the youth? You know, there'll be a mass appeal, especially for the youth.
Well, because young people in every generation have always borne the brunt of all the negatives in society, whatever's wrong in society. Well, you know, the young people in this generation, they're so terrible and they're so awful and they're so, and what in fact, the youth are a reflection of what they've seen their elders do, the reflection of their environment and things that they see and they hear and that they've experienced. And so, rather than always blaming them for things that are wrong, this is a message that will encourage them to say, hey, you know, don't feel, and I see that often as being a teacher and especially working with adolescents at the high school level. And I just feel that young people especially need to be encouraged to know that regardless to whatever challenges that they're facing, that maybe their elders did not face in their generation, that there's still hope and there's help. And they don't have to always feel as though everybody's always saying these young generations, they're terrible and they're awful, but they're not. They're not. They just need to be encouraged. And I believe that the message of this book will be an encouraging message for them.
And an encouraging message to those who may feel that society rejects them or, you know, treats them like outcasts.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because for many years, I felt that same way, even among my peers, my family members at times, and the church members, I felt that same way. And it was probably the fact that maybe they didn't understand. And I see that also a lot of times. Young people, they're often misunderstood, and they place themselves in situations of being an outcast, or they're often forced into those situations. And so I want to encourage those people, because I was one of them. I was the outcast. So I know and I understand. And this is like a message of hope, you know, where you throw out a lifeline to someone that's drowning, about to sink. I want the message of this book to be a lifeline of hope and help to draw those individuals back in to say, it's okay. You don't have to be out there by yourself. We understand. God understands. He loves you. So that's why I feel this message will especially appeal to those individuals.
We've been listening to Teresa L. Smith, the author of her book, I Hate God, I Love God, Witches in the Church. Teresa, tell us how to get your book.
Well, you can purchase a book online at lulu.com, which lulu.com is my publishing company. And also, if you'd like to make a phone call, you can call Lulu You can call Lulu at 888-265-2129, or you can visit www.lulu.com. The book is available also through your local bookseller or preferred online retailer.
Well, thank you, Teresa, for joining us on Indie Book Publishing.
Thank you again for inviting me on your show.
And this interview has been brought to everyone by Lulu Publishing.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.